dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the third night and there are going to be four interviews. Let me just get that up for you. In 2 hours, it'll be Benjamin Boyce and then the podcast Good Old Boys and then Hearthfire Radio. But first, and I guess this is the only English person this evening, I'm afraid, and this is Nina Power. Nina, welcome to Millennial. And would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Hello. Well, I'm actually Anglo-Irish. My surname Power is Irish, so I'm not fully English. But I don't know what's worse, actually, being English or being Irish.
Each one has its hang-ups.
Absolutely. I seem to have inherited the worst of both races. That's fine. It's funny and tragic. I'm a writer. I write for loads of different places. I write for The Spectator, The Telegraph. I write for Ian Hersey Alley. I do a lot of music and art and cultural criticism. I do less music than I used to do because I also got fired from like literally every job. I was an academic for 13 years teaching philosophy. I still teach philosophy online in this brave new para and post-academic world of, you know, speaking to random people on the internet who are actually very interesting, and you can avoid all of the bureaucracy and the ideology by doing your own thing, and that's very cool. I was working for Compact Magazine, but that ended in July. I am a gang stalked individual. I am basically the sort of bête noire, is that the right word? I don't know. A hated person by many people on the left. I was on the left before it went insane. Maybe it was always insane. Maybe I was also insane. But I decided to stand up for reality at a certain point, and that makes you very unpopular because it's kind of a death cult, and they want to murder you if you leave. But, you know, it's all good. I also go to church. I'm a Christian. I'm Anglo-Catholic. And, I love my plants.
Oh, good, good. So let's. There's a lot to ask about there. Let's start with the writing for The Spectator and The Telegraph. When were you there? When were you with them? Because I used to, a long time ago, I read The Telegraph, and I was like the late 2000s, and then I sort of drifted away from it and into more verboten territory, I suppose. So when were you with the mainstream media?
Well, I mean, I actually used to write for The Guardian back in 2010. Around then, I was writing a lot about police stuff and the student protests, and the right to protest was something I was very interested in as one of the freedoms of expression, of the great liberal values, which have all sort of gone very strange. And so I was always on the side of free speech and free expression. I was like, I'm Gen X, I guess millennial, so I'm older than you, and you know, growing up in the 90s, there was a kind of freedom. Nobody cared about politics. Also, politics was for absolute nerds. Like, why would you know what I mean? Like, I don't know why politics has become like people's identity and their personality. This is a terrible move. It was much more interesting when people were like pissed off with each other because they liked the wrong bands, you know, and the comedy was a lot better. And it was overly hedonistic, and people were drinking too much and having too many drugs and having pointless sex. But frankly, that was better than this kind of weird, prudish, chastise everyone. Everyone's like, you know, wrong and bad and evil thing.
Well, yeah. See, I came of age at the very end of the 90s, so I missed a lot of the fun, to be honest. By the early 2000s, things were changing and getting towards where we are now, which is a very odd sort of almost sexless. It seems like the young are scared of all of that, whereas in the 90s it was just you know, people had a lot of casual sex and promiscuous. And yes, you can decry that, but it seems to have morphed bizarrely into a sort of Puritanism that really is based on fear, as much as anything else. I mean, there's a lot. There are multiple threads there that you could pick at, but it's just an interesting thing to contrast now the life of the Zoomer today with the life of someone of Generation X in the 90s. It's really quite remarkable, and you can even see it in footage. When you look at footage of concerts, the whole atmosphere is different. The look on people's faces is different. It's much more.
But also, like, people weren't recording every last thing, you know. Like, thank goodness. Yeah. I mean, I think people look back on the past and they don't like it because it wasn't recorded. Mm. You know, that people were sort of allowed to do things and they weren't being spied on. Obviously, that surveillance, both kind of state-based and personal, has just massively increased, and everyone's become like a little Stasi agent. And of course, most of the Stasi agents were volunteers too. I forgot, I didn't actually answer your question, which is like about writing for the Telegraph. But basically, I just do a lot of writing to pay my rent. So, but I actually think the Telegraph's pretty good. I have some kind of quite serious cultural pieces, and you know, oh, it's a newspaper, so it's all like, you know, bad in a sense. But I do enjoy reviewing and all that. So yeah, that's pretty good.
Nice. And did you start at The Guardian? Was that the first one?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is when I was a student or just finished my PhD, and I was writing about the student movement, which you must remember if you were in the country or wherever you were, but around 2009, and lots of occupations.
Exactly. Occupy. Yeah, I do remember it.
And so lots of universities were occupied, and then there was lots of protest because Cameron and Clegg wanted to bring in this tripling of the tuition fees. And I was very convinced that education should be free or should be affordable, because I think that there are clever people from all different class backgrounds, and you know, I didn't want it to become this sort of elitist thing. So I was very interested in free education at that point. At this point, I think that we should close about 80% of the universities. I do think that everything should be IQ tested, and there certainly are clever people who are not rich, and I am concerned about this. So I'm still concerned about the same things, but I think a lot of universities, I think actually the percentage of people who are able to genuinely get anything out of higher education and for whom it is a good thing is much, much smaller than we are told. It is certainly not 50% of the population. And if I had my way, I would bring back, well, I'd change the economy completely. I'd make Britain self-sufficient and re-enchant it. And I would bring back you know, apprenticeships and craft schools and you know, teach people actual skills, and yeah,
I completely agree. I agree with every word of that.
Like, we don't need we do not need 50% of the population in massive amounts of debt with a sort of resentful bad reading of Judith Butler running around, you know, like, this is nobody needs that, no country needs that. You know what I mean? Like, this is a waste of everyone's time.
Well, that's kind of why they had to bring in tuition fees in the first place, because they were trying to get everyone, a huge number of people, like 50% of people, to go to university. So then that is going to cost a hell of a lot more than if only 10% of people are going. So,
well, I mean, I think let's be cynical and realistic. The reason why they did it is precisely to get people out of the workforce, to create massively indebted human beings, so they who would begin their working life in at least £50,000 or £60,000 worth of debt. So this massively diminishes people's expectations, but as we've seen, it does also generate enormous amounts of resentment in people who've been told their whole lives that they deserve some great job because they're so wonderful and brilliant, but it turns out they're mediocre and nobody wants to be mediocre.
Yeah, indeed. Would you agree with, because I'm interested in Occupy, because in my mind, and you know, memory changes things, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but my memory of the 2000s is that it was very much a sort of empty decade compared to the 90s and also compared to the 2010s. And there wasn't much political stuff going on, demos, protests. I mean, I was actually at the Iraq War protest in 2003, I think it was. There were many people there. I think they estimated it at 1 million, but I've seen different estimates. Anyway, but apart from that, there was really nothing that I can recall until Occupy came along at the very end of the decade. Was that how you remember it?
Yes, certainly 2003. But I mean, this was a very, very milquetoast protest. I mean, given that at that point that we went to Iraq, the majority of the population opposed our participation in the war. I mean, it clearly was a horrifically stupid idea. But the sort of genre of the protest was pathetic. I mean, it was people carrying signs like "Make tea, not war." You know, it was like a nice day out.
It was. I remember seeing that. I remember seeing nice middle class families, and it was kind of cute. It was touching, you know. But I also thought, is this really serious?
No, it wasn't. And I mean, frankly, with that number of people, you could storm Parliament, which people should have done, frankly. And you know, we know that the disconnect between governments or whoever pretends to govern us and the will of the people is just immense, and has only gotten bigger. And you know, Britain is a sort of offshore holding pattern for a load of nonsense. And, you know, every time anyone votes on anything serious, nothing ever happens about it. And in fact, the opposite happens. So I would say the level of political dispossession and apathy is massive. Not exactly apathy. I mean, really kind of anger, honestly, which we saw in the riots. I mean, remember there were riots in 2011 too. In England, you'll remember.
Yeah, was that in Oldham?
No, it started in Tottenham. So this was the police shot.
Oh, of course, the summer of 2011, right? Yes, of course, in London. Yeah.
And then it sort of spread to various places. But some of the policing and the imprisonments that we've seen from July this year are very similar to 2011. So the student protests, they did arrest and charge a lot of people with violent disorder. I was very, very involved in court support and trying to stop people going to prison around that time. But in 2011, which was a few months after the student protests, there was the summer riots and 24/7 courts, again, people being told to plead guilty, which is a terrible mistake. Nobody ever plead guilty, by the way. I'm telling you, this is exactly what happened in July this year. Everyone got incredibly poor legal advice or no legal advice. Everyone was pressured into saying that they were guilty, which of course means an immediate prison sentence. And if they want to make an example of you, which they did in 2011, they will give you huge sentences for incredibly minor things. And as we've seen, this is ramped up to include social media posts. But this also happened in 2011, and people shouldn't forget that people went to prison for making joke Facebook events about holding a riot in the hometown because they were so bored. Somebody went to prison for that. Somebody went to prison for stealing a bottle of water during the riots, and so on and so forth. So the state will periodically do this. Its fundamental assumption is that there is not public order, there is public disorder, and you are the disorder. And they will put, you know, they will periodically do this. And so this is what happened in July this year as well, which is just horrific.
Oh, it was frightening this year because people, I mean, we've got to assume that there is a right to protest and that protest is not always going to be pretty or orderly and that things will happen that each person is not directly responsible for. And that it would be crazy to hold them culpable for it. But Keir Starmer explicitly said that everyone present will be considered culpable. And so then, well, you've basically lost your right to democratic protest at that point, because even to be involved means that you're guilty.
Well, it's the bystanders, people recording, you know, the fact that people are also saying, you know, saying stuff on social media, going to prison. But again, there's precedent for this. But yes, I mean, the restrictions on all of this are massively increased. Starmer was head of DPP when he was deciding to prosecute the students as well. So he has a long history of doing this and practice and the rioters. So he's been doing this for a long time. Like, July is not a one-off, right?
Yeah. It's interesting because people, I had actually forgotten that. I think a lot of people had forgotten that he has a history of doing this. But he does come across as an authoritarian. I mean, he comes across as really cold and actually not even interested in coming across well, which is amazing.
No, I mean, I think this man has I mean, some sort of like personality bypass. I mean, he literally doesn't dream. He has no favorite anything. I mean, this is not a person. This is like, I don't know what it is. A sort of
an automaton,
robot. Yeah. But it's something weirder. I mean, he's obviously technically human, but like, I don't understand how somebody could just be this free of character. Like.
And also not and lack the self-awareness to hide it as well.
Well, you know, I suppose he thinks
he
calculates that by not having a personality, he won't put anyone off, because then someone won't be offended by his choice of band or whatever, or, you know, like, oh, he likes this author. And
but
really all it does is make him seem like, you know, absent of.
Definitely. Definitely. It's like there's no personality there. It's really quite remarkable. I mean, I think he is the most hated prime minister I can remember.
Also, this is unbelievably chaffy behaviour of, like, you know, taking all these bribes and free clothes and free glasses whilst pretending you're, like, moral and righteous. And, you know, these are not people who have convictions. These are not religious people. These are not people with a great moral metaphysical system. I mean, these are, like, grimy, you know, like, pretending that they are upstanding Guttermensch, you know, like, we're the good people, we've been waiting all this time while the evil Tories have done evil Tory things. But then they rock up and then they're like, yeah, can I have some free Primark clothes?
Well, it was the same in 97. I mean, you'll remember that. Yeah. Everyone was excited about New Labour. Like, I was in Scotland, rural Scotland. So, you know, a lot of people were excited about New Labour. And then very quickly it turned rotten, and Tony Blair was... And I remember there was an incident where he and his wife, they went somewhere and they were offered a free gift. And so they took a whole lot of stuff. I've forgotten what it was, but it was the same sort of grasping behavior that you're talking about there from Keir Starmer. I remember it was quite a thing at the time, quite a news story that Cherie were.
These people are so grubby. I mean, at least, I don't know, at least like hide the bribes, or like don't take like obvious things like clothes from donors. Like, it's so grimy.
Yeah, it is. It's very low grade. So in retrospect, what would you say was the meaning and the effects of the Occupy movement? Because that is something that's not often talked about now. And as I say, I think it came after a long period of stagnation in political protest in Britain. So it's interesting to think about what did it achieve, if anything, and what did it mean, if anything?
Yeah, so I mean, it's sort of 2010, 2011. I mean, there were occupations of universities in 2009 over Gaza, actually, interestingly. Then the occupations over the cuts to universities, then the student protests, then the riots, and Occupy is somewhere in between, right? I think 2011. I mean, I was friends with Giles Fraser, who gave up his churchyard to Occupy. They wanted to occupy Paternoster Square, which is in the City of London, but it turned out to be private land. The City of London in and of itself is the weirdest entity ever. I mean, they have their own laws and their own police force, their own courts. And I mean, one thing I think that was really interesting about Occupy, which has disappeared from the left completely, was this focus on economics. And the reality of the dark financial things that were going on and have always been going on. I mean, Britain is like the most corrupt country ever. We basically invented corruption and concentration camps and all kinds of things. Brilliant. Well done, us. But, you know, like these kind of chains of you know, dark money and offshoring and selling, privatizing things and the role of the City of London in all of that. That's something that some people at least were trying to do. And people became interested in around Occupy.
It was to do with the bank bailouts, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, look, forget about the 2007, 2008. I mean, this is what politicized a lot of people, was the austerity that followed from the global banking crisis. Again, we've sort of forgotten, my little chronology there. But yes, I mean, so people were focusing on the money, economics, rich people, bank, you know, corruption, selling things. And that sort of has gone, you know, that and the focus on economics, money and class has all disappeared from the left, which left it right open for the populist right to come in on that and every other issue. And all they had to do was cleave only mildly to reality. And off into insanity.
Well, it seems that there's a... My interpretation of this is that the corporations and the banks effectively bought the left or seduced the left by donning the rainbow flag and so on, and sponsoring Pride and all that. I think that had actually happened right back to the 70s, but in a very small way. Corporate. I think there was an airline in America that sponsored Pride in 1975 or something. I've forgotten now. But the point is that it was a rarity. And then in the post-Occupy, like in 2012, 2013, it suddenly became de rigueur, absolutely almost mandatory for every corporation to be involved with promoting Pride. And I think that seems to be the point at which the left became almost pro-corporate, pro-capitalism, because all of their focus then was on bigotry, small-mindedness, racism, transphobia, which is a word that nobody even knew in 2010. I mean, that's a very interesting...
Let's not forget, you couldn't change sex in 2010. That only became possible after that.
Exactly. Once the corporations got on board, they make everything possible.
Yes, they changed reality. It was incredible. I mean, I wonder about the causation there. I mean, yes, of course, woke capital is incredibly cynical. I mean, you know, HR and DI and whatever we want to say. I mean, these are they took a position and they forced everyone to go along with it. The identitarian thing, the cancel thing, that was all coming in after 2010. I noticed it around 2013. Something was going wrong. I thought, things are always going wrong. I mean, there are always purity spirals and cults and social contagion and stuff. But it became unlivable, I suppose, during the 2010s.
Oh, gosh. The 2010s, I mean, I guess you could say it all culminated in 2020, but the 2010s was a terrible decade. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a meme going around that culture hasn't changed for 20 years since the year 2000, but it's not true. In some ways, it obviously is true. Aesthetics, genres, fashions, everything is... There are no new looks anymore, no new genres. That's true. But in another sense... Culture has changed radically since 2000, but specifically since 2010. Again, this is my interpretation, that really not much change at all between 2000 and 2010. But then between 2010 and 2020, culture really did change. And one of the main ways is the obsession with gay rights, and especially trans, and the whole drag queen story hour, all of that stuff. The things that were going on in 2019 would have been unthinkable in 2010. They'd become, as I say, an everyday thing by then. And as I would say, that culture changed immensely. Things that we now talk about simply didn't exist in 2000. So I think we actually are in a period of very rapid cultural change. It's just that it's happening in terms of the morals and ideas, but not in terms of the aesthetics and the fashions and what we see and hear. That has certainly stagnated.
Why we're overdue a renaissance, that it's going to be fine. Everything is exciting again. There's going to be wonderful, experimental, futurist culture, artworks. We're all doing exciting things in London. We're only occasionally getting threatened with violence. This is just the reality. But I spend a lot of time with people who are doing exhibitions, theatre groups, you know, art and filmmaking and so on. And it is actually a lot more exciting. And I think this kind of period of like fear and just boringness because everyone's afraid is coming to an end. And like, to be honest, as someone who has been cancelled at scale massively, I find it really annoying that there are now people who never really got cancelled, who are now sort of saying, oh yes, well, the past 10 years were a bit boring. I always knew they were, but I didn't want to say anything. But now we can say it a little bit. And it's like, well, where were you when we were all getting, like, losing our jobs and stuff, you know? But there you are. It's always like this. So it's fine.
Yeah.
Let's not be resentful.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. The woke thing is now talked about in past tense, and people talk about it like, oh, remember when we wore flared trousers? Oh, that was crazy, wasn't it? Can't believe I used to do that. This sort of thing. Well, it was only a couple of years ago, and you were devout about it. But yeah, they're eager to move on, or at least to see it in a certain ironic context. But no, it was deadly serious. I mean, people.
I mean, not really ironic if you've cut your dick and balls off, though, is it? I mean, that's not really ironic.
Indeed, of course. I mean, people in the media who, I guess, their kids might have done that, but you know, it's alarming how many. But that's a whole other thing. Let's talk then about your own experience, because we've been sort of edging towards this of your time in the media and academia. So, would you like to tell your story of getting cancelled, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm like quite bored of it now. But basically, I just say, you know, I was on the left. I was very, as I say, very into freedom of expression and right to protest in particular, and education. I was working in university. I like went through the whole university system for free because I was, you know, old enough or young enough at that point or whatever. So I was very committed to intellectual matters and philosophy. I still am. I absolutely love philosophy. I love it even more now I'm out of the academy. I, like many people, especially women and probably Gen X women, the gender thing was what scuppered me, in the sense that I just couldn't take it anymore at a certain point. The cognitive dissonance was too much. People were making claims that were just blatantly untrue. People on the left wouldn't talk to me. I wanted to have conversations about what was going on. And I wasn't even like opposed in the first place. I was just like, can we talk about it? Because this seems like a major change if we're going to like radically alter what we mean by the words man and woman and stuff. And like, this has loads of implications and consequences. And like, you know, I realized quickly that it was sort of a verboten topic and you were just supposed to go along with this new set of ideas, many of which didn't have arguments attached. They were just statements that you had to go agree with. And not even agree with, you had to kind of be fully cheering for them, you know. And I started to get really, like, confused about it. And
when was that, roughly? When
so I guess sort of mid-2010s. I didn't say anything. When did I get cancelled? I think... 2018 maybe 2016, I can't remember. Basically, because I think 2018 I finally said something. I posted something very innocuous. I was a member of the Labour Party at this point. Like, I was like signed up, and they started suspending members who wanted to discuss proposed changes to the Gender Recognition Act. And I posted something really milquetoast about it. I said, like, what's going on? This is effed up. Like, why is Labour suspending these women? And then I immediately got targeted by these sort of weird, like, fake grassroots activist groups who then, like, stalked me for years, and they still do. And there's a really, really crazy activists. Who knew? They're really, like, really deranged. And they will devote, like, all their time and energy to ruining your life and ad hominem you and slandering you and you know, emailing everyone you work with, like, trying to get any gossip on you, trying to, like, ruin your life. Like, I don't know, like, really bored. Like, how bored are these people? Yeah.
Well, from their point of view, it's worth it, though, because it creates a climate of fear.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, that's what it's for, really. It's not personal in that sense. They're not doing it to hurt you. They're doing it to warn everyone else, this is what will happen to you.
Sure. And you know, I guess because I was like, you know, I was writing for The Guardian and, you know, like in a tiny world, I had like a tiny profile, but that was also enough to really get me targeted because it was like, what's the word? Pour encourager les autres, you know? It's like, okay, we're going to show what we can do to this person. Like you say, it's not personal, but if people see what we do to her, then they won't speak out, you know? So I really got it hard. And they were coming for my job. So I basically resigned all of my academic posts before I lost them. But then I lost magazine work. I was writing for The Wire, which I really liked. And that got lost. And so I ended up with these like stalkers who were basically writing open letters and, you know, defaming me. I was accused of being an anti-Semite and, you know, things that actually are very, very still extremely damaging claim. So I ended up in a legal case that went on for 5 years, and that was insane. With somebody else, a guy called Daniel Miller, who was also being defamed at scale. And because I think they regard language as like a means to an end. It's like, we want to destroy this person, so we will say anything and everything about them. You know what I mean? Because it's not about what's true.
It's hurts,
you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So I was like targeted as this enemy person. And
yeah, it's a matter of throwing labels at you, just hoping that some will stick.
Yeah,
and it will, especially if Wikipedia is on their side.
With what?
Well, I just mean that the apparatus is on side, so it will preserve things. Hope Not Hate will be a reliable source. You know,
how does this group still exist? Yeah, they tweeted their support for the person who is defaming us, as unsurprisingly, they need there to be Nazis. They need there to be bad guys. So they kind of have to invent them because there aren't actually tons of really evil Nazis running around. So everyone becomes a Nazi. TERFs became Nazis. You know, anyone who was like, I don't know, people who wrote for Brexit were Nazis. Anyone who cares about immigration is a Nazi. You know, we're very familiar with this. Very, very boring. These people are idiots, but they're sort of cunning and they're slightly evil because they know, they sort of understand black magic. They understand what words will work in order to smear someone. And the phrase cancel culture didn't exist when people started getting cancelled. When I was cancelled, it didn't exist. And it really was, like there's something wrong with this person. We don't know what it is. You create this miasma of horror. And so people just leave you alone. So you don't even know the extent to which you're being kind of blacklisted and badmouthed and, you know, because it's all kind of happening behind the scenes or like anonymously or like, anonymous open letters, like, anon accounts. It's all like very creepy.
It certainly is. And it's amazing that there is a system in place to do this kind of thing. But a lot of it is, as you say, just losers who have nothing else to do.
And some of them are really rich. Like the guy who defamed us at scale is like, he spent like more than £1 million, like on Mish Kondo Rea, who are like these insane lawyers. And we had three lawyers. And and it's like, oh. And one of his claims is that I was anti-Semitic because I said he was rich. And I said, but you are rich.
Right.
And I think it's not like I think everyone who's rich is Jewish or every Jewish person is rich. I just said, look, you happen to be rich and you happen to be Jewish. I'm not saying you're rich because you're Jewish. And this was the basis, he claimed, for why he was calling me an anti-Semite. It's not really. He was saying it because it's still a very powerful term.
Yeah.
As we saw with Corbyn, I mean, Corbyn was smeared as an anti-Semite. I mean, Starmer got rid of Corbyn by using this accusation. It just shouldn't be this powerful. I mean, at this point, I'm basically for the repeal of all hate speech legislation. I don't think any claims about groups should be treated as hate speech. I think we have laws in place that regard violent threats. Do you know what I mean? But we should not be making kind of claims about group hate speech, like the idea that this is prohibited speech, because we can just see so obviously how it's used against people, you know, for political ends constantly. I mean, the July protesters are political prisoners. You know, anyone who was saying, and the, you know, that guy turned out to be the alleged killer of these schoolgirls. Well, he's on trial for it whenever. They'll put it off for as long as possible. But people should be perfectly allowed to speculate about the, you know, beliefs of somebody who commits such heinous acts. And, you know, this is all about like controlling language and policing who is allowed to say what about which group and which people. And I wish we had the First Amendment. It's really bad that we don't.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right that it's completely selectively applied.
Of course.
The famous one is Nick Lowles of Hope Not Hate, who probably did cause some strife, let's say, by posting what turned out to be fake news about acid attacks. And he also said that there was a Telegram post advertising riots for a particular day, and he said that it was a hoax, and he knew he knew that it was a hoax.
Right, and then remember that all of the mainstream papers were lockstep the next day. You know,
absolutely.
People out for protests, Nazis, far right threat, you know. And yeah. And if you're on the left, the phrase you hear over and over again, apart from other mantras, is the far right is on the rise. Like, you know, I was on the left several years. Every year the far right was growing. Every year the far right was on. At one point I was like, is the far right ever not on the right? Like, does it ever go down a little bit or flat line? You know, but it's like it sort of always has to be growing. You know, otherwise, what's the point of these stupid people doing these stupid things?
Well, it's a crusade for them, I think.
But their enemy doesn't exist. Like, they're sort of making it up.
Mm. Yeah, I think they need to believe that there's an imminent threat because that gives their life a sort of purpose.
I mean, it gives them a hard-on. Like, why? I mean, why do they want to feel like there's something not true is happening? I don't understand this, really.
I just think that the loss of religion has left a hole in people's lives, and one of the things that they fill it with is this moral, righteous crusade about being more left-wing, more liberal, more progressive than thou. That's what I would say about that, but I don't know.
No, sure, but the problem with progressivism is it never bloody ends. It's not like they go, oh, yes, we've got gay marriage, let's stop now. It's like, no, we have to create more fake victims and fake genocides, and this group that doesn't even exist is being genocided, even though it's not, you know. So it never ends, you know. It's like we have to be more inclusive. I was thinking about the plus today, you know, LGBTQ plus. People don't use the plus anymore, but it's quite interesting. What did the plus stand for, really?
Well, I think it was open-ended. I think that was deliberate. It was like just everyone, every deviance you could imagine.
You know, these things were private for a reason, and I think that I agree the total collapse. It's of course, why would there be any restrictions? I mean, liberalism basically says you're free to do whatever you like without limits, and desire is good. And okay, there are some laws, but we're going to selectively apply them.
Do you think that they were moving towards some sort of acceptance of paedophilia?
Well, I think, like, as we've seen with PIE and stuff now, there seems to be a very, small, but concerted periodic attempt to normalise paedophilia. I think there is a small group of men, overwhelmingly, but they can rope women in because women are open to manipulation, idiotically and annoyingly. But it's easy to sort of hijack people's empathy, women's empathy, for some reason. And they periodically attempt to make it seem reasonable and normal. So I think what we basically see is a systematic but sort of, you know, every time it sort of gets pushed back, they try again a different way.
See, I don't know where else they could go. Like after the transgender thing, I don't know what else it could be. It could be necrophilia, bestiality, which actually I think is actually legal in Canada. And I might be misreporting that.
Other than that,
I don't know where else it could go but paedophilia.
Well, no, for sure. I mean, I thought they might push the dissociative identity disorder. I thought they might have another go at multiple personality disorders and people demanding rights for all of their different personas and alters, but that hasn't really become a big deal. But we have seen the normalization of mental health conditions, especially self-diagnosed ones. I mean, the internet is basically, and it's really weird because people are mentally ill, but they're not mentally ill in the way that they want to be. You know what I mean? Everyone wants the kind of sexy diagnoses. Anyway, social contagion is real. We're hugely mimetic. Who knew? There is no sort of inner identity in that sense. Like, no one is really X in the way. But we are really men and women. We all really have a sex, and there really are only two sexes. And we really do have bodies that have limits and all of these things that the entire history of humanity really, really did understand and had loads of wisdom for us that we've decided to eliminate in our stupidity.
That's the thing. I mean, we're contradicting, let's say, really the entirety of human history based on the wisdom of a few decades at most, the ideas of a few decades. And
yeah.
You'd think people would be more cautious about this. You know, giving up concepts like male and female, you'd think that they would be very apprehensive about that, because it was that these were basically the two most fundamental things about being alive. You're either male or female. It's one of those two things.
Yeah,
I mean and see, the way I would say this is, it is a mix in the sense that hormones, people have different levels of hormones in the womb, maybe throughout their lives, but ultimately every man is still a man and every woman is still a woman, and that is the archetype that they have to live up to.
And there really was a kind of, I would say, between the 70s and the 90s, a sort of growing acceptance of, like, how to put it, like a range of expression of those realities, for better or worse, right? You could say that everything is sort of prefigured in you know, the invention of the pill, the sexual revolution. You know, I'm very close to people like Mary Harrington and Louise Perry, who are very, you know, make a huge point about talking about the sexual revolution and the downside of it for women and children in particular, but actually for everybody. And the jury's in, I think, on that period. You know, we brought up in the 90s at the, it's still in full flow, I would say. You know, the liberal values of the sexual revolution were there in the 90s. And I think, really, you know, what's obvious is that it was really good for a very small number of people, those people of whom did not want to take responsibility for anything. You know, like the CAD won the sexual revolution because we could just do everything without any consequences and everyone else would have to sort of live with them.
Well, exactly. This is the irony, that the sexual revolution starts with freedom for everyone. You know, you can have lots of sex with lots of different partners. And, you know, no hang-ups, no limits and all that. But it ends with OnlyFans. And it ends with this is the current standing wave of it, Lily Phillips having sex with 100 men at once. And now she's talking about 1,000 men.
Not at once. In
close succession. Yeah, not all at once. I don't think that would be physically possible.
Nobody has that many holes.
Yeah. Well, but it ends with that. It ends with, and the whole OnlyFans thing just strikes me as it couldn't be less healthy for people. It couldn't be more toxic for people than that. And it is, ironically enough, prostitution. It's women selling themselves on nothing but their physical form, their bodies. It's as an object. It's the epitome of objectification. Well,
my feeling is that both men and women need to be better. I wrote a book which called What Do Men Want? That was out 2-3 years ago now, which categorically refused to take sides in the sex wars, which was controversial to some people because I wasn't condemning men, you know, and this was like written at the height of the whole Me Too thing, but also the toxic masculinity thing, the resurrection of patriarchy in the most dumb liberal feminist way, that, you know. So I wrote a book that was basically trying to say, like, we have to stop blaming each other, both sides, right? Like that men and women are actually compatible, complementary in their difference, and the difference is beautiful, and we could both be better, you know what I mean? Like, this isn't up to one sex to fix everything or to be blamed for everything. You know, we're all, especially, look, most of us were brought up as secular liberal subjects, like, and the fish can't see the water it swims in. You know, I recognise that liberal culture now, but I didn't recognise it at the time because it's normal. Like, there's nothing else, right? If you're 15 and this is the world you're in. And so
you've got nothing to compare it to. So
right, exactly. And you know, but I think there is, people are tired of this divisive rhetoric, and the internet rewards extremism. Of course it does. Extreme positions, and people have to up the ante by making more and more extreme claims, you know what I mean? So it pushes people into like really dramatic positions, which aren't actually real. Like, they're not borne out by people's real love for their brother or their father or their, you know, they or their wife or whatever. And then there, of course, there is resentment. I talk about the problem of the mismatch between like female desire and male desire and so on and so forth. I look at MGTOW and incels and all of this, and in the most sympathetic way, like, really, what are the arguments here? Because they are positions. They're not just expressions of inchoate hatred or whatever we're supposed to believe, right? Like, even hatred has reasons. You know, I'm pro-hate.
Do you want to be quoted saying that?
No, but what is hate? I mean, none of these people can define it in hate speech. Hate can't define it. They're just like, you know, everyone we don't like is a hater. Okay. I mean.
Yeah, and there does seem to be far more hate. Well, let's just say a lot of hatred on the left as well.
Right. I mean,
they're motivated by their hatred.
People who disagree with them mildly, you know, what's that?
I do agree that it's pointless to just blame women for feminism, and it's pointless to just blame men.
It's a speculative exercise, but you can't live like that.
No, you can't. And the other thing is that ordinary people, as you say, they just do, they pick up the threads of, they take the hints that are given to them by their society. No girl today, like some 18-year-old girl, she's not responsible for feminism. It's ridiculous to hold her responsible for it.
I mean, I think the Lily Phillips thing, which you brought up, I think, I mean, Louise Perry had a really good piece the other day that Rob Henderson and other people were circulating about this question of agency, you know, because it's always pitched as if, like, oh, either people are total victims or they totally know what they're doing and everything's intentional. And Louise was really cleverly, I think, trying to situate the relative agency in that situation, right? Like, of course, this woman chose to do this. I mean, it's not even original. I remember in the early 2000s, there was a woman who did something similar, you know, as a sort of quantitative quest. I mean, it does feel like...
Was that an art piece? Huh? Was that an art piece?
No, I don't remember. It was maybe she was like South Korean or something. There was a woman who was a porn star who, maybe she was a bit arty or something. But anyway, she did something similar. Like, how many guys can I sleep with? But I mean, the context of our age, like, why not? Because everything is quantity. Like, the bigger the better. You know, everything's about what you can measure. Like, this is what René Guénon says. You know, we live in the reign of quantity. And it is, in that sense, she's like a trooper. She's like a soldier of the reign of quantity. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a good tagline for it. I mean, the other side of it, of course, is obviously she chose to do this, but she chose to do it based on the society that she's in. And furthermore, the 100 men chose to do this.
Of course, everybody is complicit.
Everyone. I mean, imagine, I was thinking about this the other day, imagine being like man number 35 or man number 76.
Oh,
18, like, 18, I mean, what a ridiculous situation.
No, I know. I mean, of course it's grotesque, but in a way it's sort of no more grotesque than like the German state saying to unemployed women, well, sex work is work. You have to go and work in one of our turbo state brothels, which happens in Germany.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
When prostituted women talk about what it was like, they say things like, well, imagine sitting in a cafe and every man who walks through the door you have to sleep with, whether you want to or not. Like, you know, that's the reality of it. It's just grim. It's just fucking grim. Prostitution has been around for a very long time. It's not the oldest profession, by the way. That's midwifery. But, you know, there has always been some sort of thing about paying for sex, because, you know, even in a fully monogamous Christian society, which I think is would be the ideal, right, where basically everyone who wants to get married gets married, everyone lowers their expectations, people stop going on about perfect tens and, you know, the sort of big romance idea and all this nonsense. Basically, you find somebody who is hopefully relatively mentally stable, who wants the same things that you do. For most people, that would be a stable monogamous relationship and children. That's still what most people want, despite the best efforts of, you know, the deranged culture, which is convincing people they want to have polyamorous relationships with like dolphin and mushrooms and, you know, maybe of their brother or something. But nobody wants that, actually. They want someone who loves and cares about them and understands them. You know, who knew? And, you know, and yeah, it's probably better for most people to have children also, you know.
Oh, definitely.
So,
yeah. I also think that just as you get older and your lust for adventure dwindles, what you actually want, what you really want is security and safety and stability with someone else. And this is what the whole thing, this is how our forefathers, our elders knew this. They understood this. And that's part of what marriage provided for people. You know, eventually you, even as a guy, you run out of that desire for novelty. And what you actually want is stability.
No, and you can still do new things with the same person. And it's great. They remember when you did a new thing 10 years ago. Yeah. It's nice. It's someone who can like remember things with you.
Yeah.
You know, I think this kind of permanently distracted, yeah, endless novel consumerist thing is, it's just like nonsense, you know, it's like effervescent idiocy.
It is it seems like a reflection of the culture, it more broadly, that, you know, we have been converted from human beings into consumers, and consumers require endless products, and it also goes for this lifestyle stuff, and even down to sex. As I said, I think OnlyFans is really the epitome of this, where both sides are commercialized. You know, the women and the simps, the men, and it's just so heartless and soulless.
I mean, the only thing
it works because it feeds those animal instincts.
The only thing I think that's good about the mediation of the screen is that fewer people will get STDs because everything's basically just masturbation with a screen in between. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, like it's, you could read a book of poetry. You don't have to have wank. You know what I mean? Like, it's a bit boring. I think that also people, you know, that people have forgotten. This is why I'm very interested in like NoFap and the kind of semen retention stuff that you get in some of the masculinist things. I think men who do that are probably correct. You know what I mean? Like, it's not actually ideal for men to be coming all the time. I think it's probably diminishing. And
well, I think pornography definitely isn't good for people. I mean,
yeah, I mean, who the hell is promoting, you know, billions of hours of free high grade pornography? Like, that's not just there for no reason. Like, people, you know, I believe all of the conspiracies about porn, I have to say.
Yeah, it does seem like a social poison. And this is a thing that is really, I was talking to some older people recently, boomers, and I said this, I sort of alluded to it, and they were just so baffled. They were so confused by the very idea that pornography is a social ill, that it's something bad, something undesirable. And I realized, God, there's such a divide between me and them now. Because for me, it's just self-evidently, it's obvious that this isn't something good. Now, I'm not an absolutist about this. I'm, you know, realistic. But clearly, pornography enables a lifestyle and promotes ways of thinking, a culture that obviously isn't good for people. It clearly isn't. Of course it
isn't. No, I think one of the major effects it has is to create a sense of shame, which then carries over into non-pornographic life. And it's very interesting if you read some of the posts on NoFap where men who are suffering with porn addiction, or, you know, can't get out of the desire to watch it and use it, is that they start to see the whole world as a porn film, and this absolutely destroys their relationships with other people, because, you know, every time they see a woman, they imagine her in some scene. And, you know, this is like devastating for social life. I mean, the vast majority of most people's interactions are not sexual. You know what I mean? Like, you can't live in the world in that way. That's a horrible, that's a form of hell and torture for yourself, you know? And I just think I think it's extremely socially negative and individually negative. And of course, human beings are sexual. But again, this is something that our ancestors understood. I mean, it's like people are very confused about this. They think that, oh, Christians, for example, don't understand the reality of sexual desire, and they're just pretending that they, you know, they're good. But the reason why they're Christians is because precisely they do understand it. And the reason why marriage is basically this great organic social relationship is precisely because it does understand the reality of desire, and the fact that it's much better for everyone if it is contained. You know what I mean? That it is expressed in this context in a way that is socially approved of, that everybody can partake in, hopefully, or as many people as possible. And it doesn't cause chaos, ideally. You know, human beings are not ideal, let's be clear also. But Christianity says this too.
Yeah, of course, a fallen creature. Yeah, it's a system that creates stability. And again, what we've seen, while that has been dismantled, what we've seen is this unleashing of chaos and energies going in all sorts of directions. And then this is how you end up with this smorgasbord of perversions that are now running rampant. I do think that's part of it as well, because the pornography has to get ever more extreme and ever more varied in order to be more pleasing for people and to keep getting the same hit, like drugs, this sort of thing. So yeah, again, I agree with you. Monogamy is the best system for society at large, definitely. Because otherwise, what you do end up with is lots of incels and lots of whores.
I'm wondering what we might disagree on, just for fun.
Well, I don't know. There might be some controversial topics on which where do you stand on mass immigration, multiculturalism, diversity, that kind of thing?
Well, I think that difference is wonderful and beautiful, and everything has its place. I don't think mass immigration is sustainable on the scale that's happening now. And every time the British people or in other countries have voted on it, they voted to decrease it. And every time they voted to just decrease it, the governments have increased it. Which is causing huge problems, you know, as manifest in the July protests. How do I put it? There are differences in populations as a consequence of different environments and millions of years of evolution. And that's a good thing. That's just how it, and it's not even a good thing. It's just how it is. You know what I mean? And there's always been interchange and travel, but it would obviously be a lot better for everyone if there were more stable countries everywhere. People could stay where they grew up and enjoy their culture and have a stable and peaceful and prosperous life. I mean, this is almost like a mercantile image of the world in which there are cultural differences that are preserved and protected, and that basically everybody works for a kind of differentiated market, but everybody can stay where they are because it's safe. I mean, you know, the push for isolationism, whether America will ever achieve it, I mean, makes great sense. I think America should put all of its bases out of the world. This is complicated. America is still the world's policeman. We do live in the American Empire. I'm kind of interested in what China is doing in Africa. It seems to me a form of like quite intriguing neo-colonialism. We'll see. But yeah, I love people. I'm a Christian. Everyone is a child of God. But I don't think we should put everyone in the same place. And I don't think we should make culture homogenous either. That would just be an extremely boring world apart from anything else.
And that is actually the result of mixing cultures together. You end up with a homogenous...
Well, overly so, yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, if you just have like a kind of one world global shopping mall, like that's boring.
Yeah. See, this is the funny thing. Like, what you said about different groups are different because of how their histories, how they've evolved and what they've experienced and so on. And I certainly agree. And it's funny because that's actually real diversity.
Yeah, of course.
What the left talks about when they talk about diversity, it's a harmless, it's something that doesn't matter at all. It's like, we're diverse in the sense that we wear different clothes or we listen to different music, but we're all the same, really.
Right.
You know, underneath, we're all the same. So therefore, there's no harm that can come from combining us. And forcing us to coexist. But then, so diversity is meaningless in that conception.
Yeah, of course, and they don't mean it. I difference is really cool. Like, this was something that I think the 90s really did understand, actually, that there was a kind of love of difference and a celebration of it, but it was not pretending it didn't exist. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, wow, you're from, like, Ethiopia. That's really cool. Like, tell me about Ethiopia. You know, like...
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about like dance tracks like Enigma, where you've got the chanting, the, you know, because it was exotic. It was something, it was a novelty.
Good. Like, I'm exotic to someone who lives in Saudi Arabia, no doubt. Like, that's cool. That's, I sound ridiculous now, but I don't know. It was very interesting in the anti-globalization movement in the 90s, which was ostensibly leftist, but this was actually about preserving different cultures against a global homogenizing force. And that was a leftist movement. So it's not like the left don't understand or didn't understand this crushing power of this global homogenizing market. And they were precisely in favor of defending difference and stopping people being bombed to crap so that they felt they had to leave and all of the other pull factors. And there are many pull factors, and I think people should be honest about it. Yeah, I mean, of course people want to move to richer countries, you know, but if we made everywhere like as successful as possible, however we do it, people won't want to leave because they'll be having a nice time.
It's interesting because I think this is a big thing on the right now, the anti-globalism,
right?
Because you've got to distinguish between globalization as a set of processes and factors and structures and globalism as an ideology. I'm definitely anti-globalism, but I don't... Like, I like that USB works everywhere, you know, that sort of thing, because it's useful, it's handy. But so I have sympathy with globalization to some extent. I think it's useful. But I wish it didn't dismantle everything in its wake. I wish it didn't just steamroll over culture, history, identity, heritage, and so forth. I wish it didn't morph into globalism, basically.
I think the reality is that's unavoidable. Like, we do live in a global world, and the internet and all these things in the global market. I mean, there's about three tribes that periodically throw spears at drones. But, you know, look, the whole world is... known, everyone is known, everything is known, hence now we have to leave for Mars, but it's all over. But how do I put it? I think, look, realistically, the battle is going to be, and I think people like Peter Thiel and others understand this, is going to be over how the global is managed, who gets to run things in a way, like what the global superstate or elite look like. I think that's the reality. You know, sod my 90s rave fantasies of, you know, beautiful difference. It's like one world alliance.
Yeah, see, I've got nostalgia for that because I was just a bit too young to partake in it. So
me too, in a way. But always being a bit too young is precisely what nostalgia is, really.
Yeah. But I saw it on Top of the Pops. I saw it in films. You know, all of that. So I did witness it in that sense. But it seemed like I think the left were ahead of the right on this. I think the right took a long time to catch up to how awful capitalism. I mean, obviously, the centre-right is still in love with capitalism. They're still blind to this. But I think what you might call the dissident right have been aware of this for a good 10 years now, that capitalism is a destructive thing. As much as it's creative and constructive, it's very destructive.
Yeah, and I think we have to be precise about what we mean. I mean, you know, I think there's a kind of romantic anti-capitalism, which is not, you know, is in favour of markets, but free market capitalism in the global sense. And I mean, look, the amount of money that people make from, frankly, illegal processes, like not immoral, and well, that's difficult, isn't it? How we talk about these things, but you know, people make money off of the very worst things. You know, financial speculation is pretty evil. It takes us a long way away from nature and the protection of things that really matter. You know, money for its own sake. Yeah, I don't know what we do about that.
No, I don't know what we do about that either. As you say, we are enmeshed in this world, and it is still the way things are, and it's the way things are going to remain for some considerable time, unless everything just collapses. But
oh yeah,
yeah. I don't know. I think with Trump coming in, I think that's going to re-energize America in a way that it's been sort of in the doldrums for quite a few years, quite a long time. I think he is going to revitalize that. So this whole thing is going to go on a bit longer than it might otherwise have done. And so that's both good and bad in a way. It means the stagnation will continue. And I don't know, America, I think, is going to be very wealthy. That's, I mean, I might be completely wrong. Maybe I'll eat these words, but it seems to me that America is going to be very wealthy under Donald Trump over the next 5 years or so. Hmm. But Europe, I can see it being a very different situation.
I feel like we're living in a Chinese theme park, honestly. I think that basically China own us already, and that we're basically all playing roles as, like, you know, actors in a theme park. This is quite a Philip K. Dick fantasy. I can see our imminent future in this way as, like, off-world theme park or something.
the Chinese, I don't know. That gets into geopolitics about Russia and so on. The Chinese seem to be colonizing the West. I know that Australia, Canada, especially Vancouver, various parts of America, they're buying up all this property. So I know that's going on. But in terms of being a global power, I don't know about that. I think America is still, but then again, America's heavily indebted to China, I believe.
Completely.
This is the kind of thing that I should know. But
you know, it's like with gambling. The Chinese are fantastic gamblers. You know, this is, they see everything in this way, and like they've said, look, we've got a 100-year plan. They're like the sort of Chris Rufo of countries. They're like, we're going to do this thing, and then they do it. So I think China have a lot of power. They have a lot of financial power. It's like when you say the house always wins. You know, if you own all the bets, you know, people might think they're winning their round, but they don't. The house always wins, you know, because they
of course
everyone's debt. So I feel like China are in this role in a way that they're sort of biding their time. I mean, they have issues of their own. They stopped the one-child policy too late in many ways, and their economy is obviously way too dependent upon export. Depending on what Trump does with tariffs, this is a big question. But I don't know. I mean, but why not? Like, all empires fall. Like, of course, the Roman Empire fell. America's gonna fall. China will fall. It's all good.
Eventually, but probably not within our lifetimes, though. We're gonna have to endure this.
Our lifetimes, you know.
I mean,
you know what I care about? I care about the preservation of Western art whichever power best looks after the cultural artifacts of the West, that's who I want to win. Whether it's the West itself or whether it's China, I just want someone to look after the art properly for as long as possible.
Yeah, I also feel very protective of our cultural inheritance, especially fine art paintings. That's why it's so disturbing when you see these activists, damaging paintings recently, the Just Stop Oil people.
Yeah, I've written about this.
it's just so ugly. And they did actually do it for real. The most recent one was they ripped, I've forgotten who it was. I think it was in Oxford. This girl knifed a painting.
Mm-hmm. And, she was never, I don't know, they didn't find, or they claimed not to know who it was. There was no consequences for this. Yeah, this was a Balfour. She destroyed a painting of Balfour because of over Israel.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is a very contentious topic. I think that what scares me the most is that the idea of European cities falling and the art collections just being raided and destroyed, by people who don't care about them. It's not their inheritance. That really scares me. And I like to think that in such a scenario, these paintings, these sculptures would be looked after. There'd be some underground base where they're protected in the side of a volcano or something like that, where no one could ever get to them. We do have a tremendous inheritance in Europe. And that, I think, is part of the threat of mass capitalism, is that it doesn't care about things like that. Mm-hmm. It has no value because you can't put a price tag on Hamlet, for example. And so it's not quantifiable, and it kind of gets in the way. It kind of gets in the way of commerce. So, this is a whole thing that I think global capitalism has degraded people in that sense, because ordinary people no longer even aspire to understanding that kind of thing, understanding fine art, high culture, good drama. That's something that has fallen by the wayside. I don't know if you'd have anything to comment about that.
To some degree, I don't know. I mean, I work in adult education and I meet a lot of autodidacts, and I think the internet is actually one of the good things it has done is precisely provide access to enormous amounts of extremely intelligent work and literature and reproductions of artworks. I mean, perhaps museum attendance is still quite high and so on. I don't know. I actually do think there's quite a thirst for intellectual matters. And actually, I've met so many people over the last 10 years who've been almost like randomly moved by something they've seen on YouTube or some lecture or something, just something they've come across, and have gone into it hard. You know what I mean? Like people who maybe didn't enjoy school or whatever, but got gripped by something. So I think this is happening quite a lot. And when I speak to Zoomers, who I'm now like old enough to be their mum, they are like the most syncretic people. They've grown up with the internet and they've read like 7 trillion things in a really weird way. And it's astonishing. So like people have access to stuff. I mean, gosh, when I was at school, someone randomly gave you a book or lent you a book. Like that was kind of it, you know what I mean? Like, but it was amazing it's very arbitrary. It's like, depending on who you'd encounter, like someone was like, I really enjoyed this book. You know, someone gave me The Female Eunuch when I was like 16, a teacher or whatever. I was like, all right, someone gave me Virginia Woolf. And it meant a lot. It means a lot. But now you've basically got everything.
Well, that does interest me. It's something I was going to ask you about. You mentioned at the start about cultural renaissance going on just now in London. Does that link to what you're saying here about Zoomers?
I think so. In some ways, yeah. It's interesting. Like the pendulum swings. The Zoomers I've met are very, very au fait with the ideology and the culture and how to sort of play it and how to go along with it, but they don't believe in it at all. And as far, this is generalizing, but I would say that they do not like millennials. They think the millennials are like weird and whiny and pathetic. And
well, they, I can't really refute that.
And they're quite cynical about playing the game, because I think they also largely think that there is no game for them to play anymore. And in that sense, they're much more like Gen X, who are like, well, you know, you can't lose if you don't play, you know. And I think Gen Z are like, well, we could play, but there's nothing for us to win, so we may as well do what we want, in a way.
They do seem very cynical. Whereas
yeah,
the millennials,
I understand think, why.
Yeah, I mean, the millennials, and I think this certainly applied to me, we sort of went into adulthood in good, in very good faith.
Right.
You know, we thought that everything was as we'd been told, and you know, that there was a career ahead of us,
yeah,
and all of this kind of things, stability, employment, and then by the time we reach our 40s, we've really been through the battles and realize that that's not the case. But the reaction of a lot of millennials to that is to retreat into a sort of childlike state, or to commit themselves to progressive politics, because you know they don't earn much, they've got no real future, but at least they've got this.
Mm.
So that's been a, yeah, I could talk about the millennials for a long time. But
like Gen X has like good record collection and comics, and like we were the last of like, they still had objects, you know, object culture, not just like little files on a computer.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, I know there was a vinyl revival thing as well, though. But
yeah, yeah, that was but that was only a minority thing. I mean, that does seem to be something that Gen X and Zoomers have in common, the cynicism, basically, that mm-hmm. they assume that society is somewhere between a trick and a joke.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I mean, you know, there are very big downsides to that. I mean, Gen X is extremely suicidal generation, and yeah, personally speaking, but also more culturally, I mean, the number of Gen Xers who have died of suicide or drug overdose is really high. And there's something bizarrely depressed and, I don't know, unworldly about Gen X too. And like when I was researching a piece on this, it was even worse than I thought, because I thought this anecdotally. I was like, yeah, and just number of people I know killed themselves, and then the drugs, and you know, for some people the party never stopped, right? And that, you know, I like, lots of people have addiction issues, I do as well, and I, how do I put it, but it's like the suicide like tracks Gen X. So it's like when we were in our 20s, it was 20 somethings killing themselves, and now we're in our 40s and 50s, and it's like, this is the group of people that kill themselves. It's like millennials just moan about things, but they don't die. And I think basically what they did was like, it's a preventative, so if you complain enough, you just stay alive, because you, maybe someone will listen eventually, you know. Whereas yeah, you're just like
yeah,
I
can understand that. Would you like to talk about the cultural renaissance now, because that is something, yeah, that interests me. I don't know how much you would have to say about that, but it's something that definitely sounds like I should ask you about.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, simply put, people are very bored about being lectured to. I mean, you know, woke culture is just incredibly boring because it's stupid, it's metaphysically inaccurate, and nobody wants to be told what to think by stupid people or people who are like less intelligent than them. Like nobody wants to watch like a quality drama in which you're being told that like white people are bad, you know, like it's also like, it's sort of banal and wrong and depressing. And so I think people are very bored and frustrated with the stupidity of culture in that sense. They don't want a moral lesson. I mean, that's why I actually think the film Tar, I don't know, did you see Tar?
I didn't, but I read a review of it, and it seemed interesting.
Yeah, like kind of bourgeois, middle-class Hollywood film. But what was really interesting about it was the character, the main character, the conductor, played by Cate Blanchett, was so morally ambiguous, and she was like monstrous, And this felt like a sort of line in the sand that some people in Hollywood were like, you know what, we're sick of this good character, good person, bad person thing, you know, oppressor, oppressed narrative. We're going to have this character who's very beautiful, but and very, very driven, but extremely morally mixed. You know, we're going to cause confusion in the hearts and minds of viewers in an adult way. Like, this was an adult film for adults. This was not someone talking down to you and telling you what you should think. And I thought that was an interesting moment in what I can see is a recommitment to, yeah, moral ambiguity, evil, the problem of evil, which has never gone away. You can't just say this group of people are evil and, you know, because of history or whatever, it doesn't solve the problem. You know, Solzhenitsyn says, you know, it's in the heart of everyone, good and evil cross the heart of everyone, which is true. Like the people I know in theatre, you can't really do theatre if you're constantly worried about offending people. You know, like when you're doing workshops and stuff, you have to be disinhibited. You know what I mean? Not just when you're playing like bad characters or morally ambiguous. You have to workshop all kinds of things. And same for writers, same for artists. So I think there's just actually, people are so tired of these like moral.
See, it's that sense of having a gun pointed at your head. So it's very difficult in that situation to be creative be
and also identity doesn't produce good art. And people were getting money off the back of who they were, or who they said they were, from art funding organizations, and then having to produce work in line with who or what they are. But this is like incredibly boring because people are not. What's interesting about someone might be that a tiny bit, but it actually isn't really. You know what I mean? Like, it's all of the tensions and the contradictions and the paradoxes and the lack and the pain and the suffering and all of that. It's not, I'm this person from this place and da, 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 I have this identity. And, you know, it can't be, it's not reified in that way. Like, art is about tragedy and comedy and violence and evil and envy and desire and all of these things. It's not about a little tick box category. I think there's huge pushback already happening, and people are just setting up their own things because all of the institutions are captured. You can't go through them. You won't get money. Oh, except that, really hilariously, my friend who runs an art gallery got an AI to write a funding application. He never gets funding for anything, but he asked the AI to write it and he got funding. So I would suggest, if you're an artist, if you're applying for anything like that, just get an AI to write it, because then you don't have to spend any time on it and it actually works. Because if you think about it, these are basically like machinic people reading machinic prose for machinic, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's like institutions reading itself. And
well,
they
might have been an AI that read it.
Well, indeed. So why not just like give the machine some machine and then you get some money and then you know what you like, you know, have a party or whatever.
What do you think about the condition and the future of the BBC?
Oh, my God. I mean, they're like a sort of paedophile, you know, pen full of horrible people, and they never like cleaned house on that. Their whole output just seems like a confession of evil, you know, like it's like drag queens, you know, every program has like 79 drag queens on it. Like I haven't had a TV for years and I don't pay the license, obviously, but every time I watch it at my parents' house, I'm just like, it's like a sort of demons, you know, so weird. And I mean, they just lie about everything. it's just clearly untrue, everything they're saying and doing. So I would abolish a license. I mean, certainly don't, like, what the hell? Why are like there loads of women in prison because they haven't paid their TV license? Like, this is like insane.
Yeah. I know that there was a move quite recently to prevent that happening, but I don't know if it actually went through or not. Mm-hmm. But the BBC, it just seems to me that it's completely moribund at this point.
I mean, I listen to Radio 3 because they have classical music on and very little, you know, ideology or whatever. Yeah. Probably there, but they, you know, it's not what they're for. So, but yeah, I hope they go down. I think they're over.
It just I agree. I wish I could have affection for the BBC, but it just and once upon a time, I think it was a great thing, a great institution. But at this point, it just seems to be, as you say, it's stagnant within itself. It serves to keep British culture stagnant. I'm not surprised at all that there are moves against it and under a subculture developing in opposition to that kind of thing. And I'm glad that that's happening because it's, as you say, it's not going to happen in the mainstream.
No, I'm excited, and I think the fact we've had enough time now to set up our own institutions, and they're much smaller, they're much more mobile, they're not filled with any of this crap, we can just do what we like and put on genuinely interesting shows and performances and discussions. People are having talks and meetings, reading groups and stuff all over the place. So yeah.
Great, great, that's great. I'm very pleased to hear that. There was one super chat, and this is, I don't know what you'll think about this. Someone asks, Nina, this is very much about, I'll word it differently.
Is it so awful?
No, I don't know. It might, what would you say about mass immigration and the survival of Europeans
The survival, like in what sense do
in
you?
group terms, like the existence of a European race.
I is there a European race? I mean, I'm Anglo-Irish. I mean, there are clearly different populations in Europe with different histories. I mean, the Irish have huge problems with alcohol. It's definitely true. I mean, that would be terrible. I mean, I don't want different races to disappear. I want them to thrive in their own places. I mean, is the question like a great replacement type question, or
Yes,
a kind of?
yes, yes.
I mean, I don't know if there's a concerted effort to stop European people from having children. Clearly, the birth rate is very low. It's also very low in it, I mean, it's going down everywhere, as far as I understand it. I mean, it's really low in places like South Korea and Japan, and lots of advanced. And I think there's multiple reasons for declining birth rates, which, and I'm not into the demographic stuff. I know people who are. It's not how I see things. I'm not very good with stats and all that, but. I understand this is a question, and I don't know to what extent there is a deliberate, malevolent, and concerted effort to replace white Europeans or different European populations with people from other parts of the world. I mean, I guess the point would be at this point, someone would say the purpose of the system is what it does, I guess. So you'd say, well, who benefits from mass immigration? Is this merely a kind of attempt to delay certain major questions, some of which are economic, although it doesn't look like the economic argument for immigration really holds up anymore, if it ever did.
No.
So yeah, I mean, it's clearly not, it doesn't serve any, even if you were looking at this from a purely utilitarian point of view, it doesn't work. You know what I mean? Like this. Mass immigration is not solving any problems. It's creating problems, clearly. I mean, where I live, someone was murdered in the street outside my house in the market the other weekend, and it barely made the news. He attacked three people with a machete or whatever, an 8-inch blade, this guy from Somalia, and killed somebody, and two other people put in hospital. And you're like, yeah, like, why did that happen? Like, why is this person there? Why is he mentally ill? Why is he, well, whatever? Why is he running around with a knife? Why are people dying? Like, the levels of unnecessary violence that are happening don't seem to be in anyone's interest, including the people committing the violence. Like, this is not, I mean, things are not working, So, I don't know. I honestly don't know if there is a deliberate policy or whether this is just a series of like incredibly poor decisions made by idiots. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a huge question, and I wasn't sure whether to ask it to you because, but it is
I'm not the right person to ask about it. I mean, unless people just want me to say something spicy for fun, you know.
No, not at all.
But I'm just not that informed about it, and I know I do read people who are. It's just not my like thing in a way.
Yeah, I get it. It was a super chat that was posted, so I felt.
Oh, it's all good. I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah, but I can see that obviously this is not your wheelhouse. You're more into culture and psychology and art and all of that kind of thing, which once upon a time was my wheelhouse as well.
Oh, yeah.
I try to get back into it now.
Well, times, good times.
Yes. Well, I'm on Substack, and that's really what I concentrate on there.
Oh, I love Substack. Yeah. I'm so pleased about it. It's like I moved over there after I was cancelled yet again and basically being mobbed on X and whatever. And Substack's just fantastic. Well, this is part of my excitement, actually. It's just so many brilliant and often anonymous, pseudonymous writers, both literary and you know, doing political commentary. It's cool. It's a very good, very good place.
It really does feel like a burgeoning area, a platform that's just full of ideas and full of new voices. So I love it as well. Mm-hmm. I did look for you on Twitter because I like to link to everyone's, like each guest that I have on, I like to link to all of their social media, but I couldn't find you on Twitter. So I imagine you closed it down.
I did. Well, I was working for Compact and it was sort of tied with that job. And then because of like one of these crazy people was like leaking chats from private chats from the court case. And then I was getting mobbed, and he was framing them as if this proved that I was like loved Hitler and that I was an anti-Semite and racist and all, you know, all of these things that you know, that allow the left to want to murder you. So I was just like, screw this, you know. And I don't like the mind effect of X. It's too fast and it's too compulsive, and I much prefer Substack. It's much the long. I started reading a lot more long form again, and that's just a lot better. It's just much more interesting.
Yeah, it's a sort of return to blogging in a way. But
yeah, exactly. And I was always into blogging. Like I had a blog in like 2003, 2004.
Oh, was it LiveJournal?
No, we had like Blogger. But I was
blogger.com. Like, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, like the group around Mark Fisher. We all had blogs at that point. Mark was sort of encouraging lots of people to write blogs, but they weren't linked up in the same way that Substack allows for the linking. So yeah,
aspect of social media there. Yeah, well, that's great. I hope that people have a look at your work. This has been an interesting conversation. So thank you. I hope it doesn't bring you much heat, because I am quite controversial myself. So
no, like, don't worry. Look, I'm basically Hitler. Like, it's fine. People make videos saying that I'm the most evil living person alive or something. And no, like, I honestly, I'm hated and cancelled on a scale like you can't imagine. I don't know how to put this. I mean, if I'd murdered 79 million babies, I'd be less controversial to some people. Like, I'm no. Okay. I can't begin to tell you. I'm glad you don't know. You're gay for having me on. But also, listen, I don't have any employers anymore. Like, I have lots of freelance work. There's like nothing, there's no one thing that anyone can cancel me from. I'm like uncancelable in the sense that I've been so cancelled that, you know, it's all fine. I can say what I like. It's good. I'm free.
That's the thing about being doxxed and being cancelled, is that it can only happen once, really.
So, well, you say that. I think that's sort of like twice massively.
Well, yeah.
And then multiply in smaller ways.
It sounds laugh. Like you've got it quite bulletproof now, so I'm glad.
I'm fine.
All right. Well, excellent. This has been a really fun conversation. So thank you very much for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you for inviting me. I hope they all go well and that you have a lovely Christmas and New Year.
Okay, you too. Thank you very much. Okay, well, I'll be back soon with the next one. But in the meantime, well, we're finishing in good time. We've got half an hour. So, I'll be back with Benjamin Boyce. But in the meantime, thank you, Nina, one last time.
Thank you. Random person, I don't know your name.
Colin.
Colin.
Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.